until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of the nations shall be his.
No wonder how complicated things get, what with one thing leading to another, said E.B. White, and he wasn't kidding.
In 2014, Richard Thieme gave a speech at the DEF CON Hacker Conference in Las Vegas, Nevada. In that 50-minute speech, he laid out how governments operate around the world, spinning endless yarns designed to confound and confuse their target populations and even their own employees in the intelligence communities. He explained how the only way to tell the truth in a national security state is in fiction and the popular culture, without fear of arrest. He explained how people often want to be deceived, as the truth is often unpleasant and anxiety-provoking. Thieme explained how the CIA became the largest publisher of art and literature in the world in their quest to fight Soviet propaganda. They surmised, they lie, and we must lie to counter them. Thieme ends with how the CIA planted news stories in the Italian press, which made their way to the New York Times, became a book, and was picked up by the Secretary of State, who had to be told, after a six-month investigation, not to worry, it was a fake story planted by the US intelligence community to begin with.
Remember what Nietzsche said a long time ago. When one is confronted with the unknown or danger or discomfort, the first instinct is to abolish the discomfort and the pain. Any explanation, he said, is better than none. Because what you want to do is get your head rid of oppressive representations. One is not particular about how we get rid of them. The first one that explains it in a familiar and comforting way is the one that people grab a hold of. And the proof of pleasure is the criterion for truth. And therefore people believe a construction of reality which is congruent with their altogether present and previous construction of reality, rather than allowing anomalous information in because it simply causes too much discomfort. And we call that explanation the truth. And then when we pass it around to other people, we have an agreement and a consensus, and then it becomes orthodoxy and even scientific truth. So the conversations were about sensitive issues, and at one point in them, a deputy director of the agency said, you know, you can't ever discuss what we talk about with you. And then he said, well, unless you start writing fiction. Fiction is the only way you can tell the truth. And that rang such a bell for me because, as I found in Tim Melley's wonderful book, The Covert Sphere, here was an academic in Ohio, wrote a whole book on exactly that same theme, because post-World War II, fiction has become the only way we can tell the truth, and that is true for people inside the community as well. I got a phone call from a different friend at the agency, and he said, this reminds me of 3 Days of the Condor, the Redford movie about the analyst who reads fiction to find out what's going on. 95% of your story isn't fiction, he said. but you have to know which 95% to have the key to the code. So he was right. And we agreed that people would think the stuff about Roswell, my little sci-fi scenario, of aliens crashing their scout ship loaded with computer chips and fiber optics and the like, so that humans would build the internet because they were finding it so boring and tedious to go to cocktail parties in Georgetown to try to learn everything they could about us. And it was so much easier to give us the means of building the internet onto which we would then project the total contents of our lives and work and souls. And they could just download Earth thinking, which was much more convenient. Well, this is an agent saying, let me tell you what we do. I'm not going to read the whole thing. You can look at the story in the book. It's called Zero Day Roswell. But the part of the story that was true was all the things that he said is what we do, because I knew that this is what we do. The story was published in 2006. Now, Tim Melly, the academic I mentioned, said this: when democracy relies on entertainment to provide knowledge of its secret affairs, as in fact all of the stories one way or another in mind games do, the contradictions of empire are normalized to invisibility through a blurring of fictional and real operations. Now, here's an example. Animal Farm was an animated film, full-length animated film. I still call them cartoons because that's what we called them when I was growing up. But it was a full-length film of the George Orwell book, Animal Farm, and it was made by the CIA. It was created entirely by the CIA, manufactured by the CIA, and disseminated by the CIA through other fronts. And that was typical of what was being done in the 1950s. It was a suspension of democracy, a conscious decision by the government to suspend democracy in its actions in order to preserve democracy in its fictional context, i.e., our lives. And in that context, the CIA in the 50s and 60s became one of the largest sponsors of art and literature in the world. They stood up magazines, periodicals. My own encounter with that was I took a course at Northwestern for Stephen Spender, the British intellectual, and he was the editor of Encounter. And Encounter for 20 years was the leading non-communist left-wing periodical in Europe, intellectual periodical. And he claimed at the end, his wife Natasha said he was so naive he probably meant it, that he didn't know that for those 20 years, the only reason funds continued to flow into the magazine is that from the beginning to the end, it was a CIA operation. And there were 20 other major periodicals in the world and many other minor periodicals, as well as using the periodicals in the media of the world or making movies. The CIA published, not under its own imprint, but through regular publishers, things are not what they seem, over 1,000 books. It appointed itself a Ministry of Culture to combat the Soviet Ministry of Culture. And the way George Kennan put it George Kennan was one of the formulators of our foreign policy under Eisenhower, and he said we need to act after the 1947 National Security Act in such a way that the U.S. can publicly disclaim any responsibility for the covert actions we do, because Eisenhower realized early on, you can read a book called Total Cold War, 600 pages about that, Eisenhower realized that in the absence of a nuclear exchange, which sane men and women would not have, the only way to win and fight the Cold War was through words, icons, glyphs, symbols, through propaganda, through disinformation. And there was no way to do disinformation that did not cause blowback, that is, that did not include all of the American people in the false scenarios and creative narratives that came out and through the media into the mind of society without having everybody part of that disinformation campaign. You couldn't deceive the Soviets without deceiving the American people. And so the American people themselves became subject to the propaganda campaign that we instituted in order to fight the Cold War. I mentioned brothers, John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles, John Foster at State, Alan at CIA, who worked in tandem to create the kind of world they did. And their first adventure was to overthrow Mossadegh in Iran at the behest of the British, who were afraid their oil interests were going to be nationalized by a duly elected, democratically elected head of government. And then we did our bends in Guatemala. And to do our bends, Eisenhower called on Eddie Bernays, the father of spin, to do it properly. And the whole religious system in Guatemala was used. Priests were stood up and fed the kinds of lies that they had to promulgate from the parish to the faithful who believed them about false things about Arbenz, so they would fear him and support the overthrow again of a democratically elected government. So the Cold War became a war fought through symbols, words, propaganda. They lie, we have to lie. And that became the method of exchange, the shaping of the mind of society, not only in the globe, but in our country as well. And the problem was that when you do that, in a nation that is now governed by compartmentalization, one of my friends at NSA said, you know more about the big picture, that pointillism standing back, because you talk to so many different people and you sure know how to connect the dots. He said, I'm constrained by compartmentalization. The example he gave was that he only recently found out that a program he worked on at the agency in the 1980s, while stood up for one purpose, actually had a completely different covert purpose, and none of the people working on the program knew what that ultimate real intention and aim of their program was for about 20 years, because they did not have a need to know. And therefore, people inside the IC are often subjected to the same propaganda, the same narratives that we are, because they can't go elsewhere inside the IC to ask what the truth is. And out here we kind of can, but we can only express it without fear of jail or exile in fiction. This is where it began, this particular story, in a small Italian newspaper where a piece of really great investigative reporting revealed that the KGB during the Cold War was sponsoring terrorism all over the world and supporting groups that were antithetical to the United States and its intentions. That small story caught the attention of an author and a journalist who wrote a piece about it for the New York Times and also wrote a book about it. And that came to the attention of Alexander Haig, who was Secretary of State. And he became very, very alarmed. And he held a press conference in which he demanded that the CIA explore this revelation in order to counter the nefarious and insidious work of the KGB in this way. William Casey, I believe it was, director of the CIA, said, "We'll get right on it." And then 6 months later, the result came back. We've explored that, and you don't have to worry about that particular thing. Why? Because the story in the Italian newspaper was a CIA plant in the first place. In other words, it was just propaganda to smear the Soviets, but it was picked up by our own journalists who didn't know any better and couldn't, turned into a book which went to the Secretary of State, and then it became an alarming consideration, and the CIA could not tell him the truth. Well, finding out what's true is not easy. You know the story of the gnome in the woods. A man went into the woods to find the gold, and he got a hold of a gnome, which according to folklore has to tell the truth, and he said, "Which is the tree under which the gold is buried?" And the gnome had to point it out, and he said, "I'm going to go get a shovel." He tied his scarf around the tree. He said, "You have to promise not to remove the scarf." And the gnome, promised he would not. And he went and got the shovel, and he came back, and the gnome had kept his promise. He had not removed the scarf, but he had tied a scarf around every tree in the forest. This is what it becomes like to find the gold of the truth.
How little has changed. Consider the fascinating perspective of Russian Jewish oligarch Boris Berezovsky, once the most powerful of the Russian oligarchs and the puppet master behind President Boris Yeltsin during the late 1990s. After looting billions in national wealth and elevating Vladimir Putin to the presidency, he overreached himself and eventually went into exile. According to the New York Times, he had planned to transform Russia into a fake two-party state, one social democratic and one neoconservative, in which heated public battles would be fought on divisive, symbolic issues, while behind the scenes, both parties would actually be controlled by the same ruling elites. With the citizenry thus permanently divided and popular dissatisfaction safely channeled into meaningless dead ends, Russia's rulers could maintain unlimited wealth and power for themselves with little threat to their reign. It's a formula taken to new heights in the lead-up to the US midterm elections of 2018 and the theatrical circus of the Donald and Hillary show. While spectacular in its never-ending allegations against the incumbent president, apparently under siege in the White House, the Don is allegedly creating domestic and foreign policy one midnight tweet at a time in between burgers and Diet Coke, but perhaps the more astute observer senses that behind the lights and stage smoke, a more sinister show goes on out of sight of the average observer. This documentary shines a light in that direction and takes the view that to understand the present, we must understand the past and go back over the distance, facts and figures to get a sense of future directions. This emerging narrative posits that while shadow boxing fills the stage in Washington, D.C., a certain English gentleman, known as Lord Jacob Rothschild, head of the most powerful banking dynasty in the world, is busy building his personal project spanning the Eurasian continent, the Belt and Road Initiative, formerly known as One Belt, One Road. This massive infrastructure project was supposedly postulated in 2013 as a way to stimulate the world economy and lift Asia out of poverty. But it is in fact a central core plan, years in the making, setting up the Rothschild City of London East India Trading Company New World Order Economic System. The estimated cost is over $20 trillion through till 2030. China is where the spotlight is shone as the driving force, but Israel is the real center of attention. This is the Bunting Cloverleaf map. It is found within the Iran Lahore map collection in the National Library of Israel in Jerusalem. A mosaic model of the map is installed on the fence of Safra Square at the site of Jerusalem City Hall. Jerusalem is in the center of the map, surrounded by the three continents of Asia, Europe, and Africa, comprising three leaves of a clover shape. The top right leaf shape, colored in green, represents Asia. The top left one, coloured in red, represents Europe, and the bottom one, coloured in yellow, represents Africa. The three continents include captions of their various countries and illustrations of some of their cities. This map was drawn in 1581, depicting Jerusalem at the centre of the great pan-Eurasian trading routes, and this is exactly what the current-day Belt and Road Initiative seeks to establish, making Jerusalem and the long biblically prophesied Greater Israel the centre of trade, politics, and culture, replacing the United States as the world's leading light and the human race's bright, shining destiny. North America is depicted in part off to the side labelled the New World, a seeming unrelated sideshow to the main game of dominating the Eurasian landmass, certainly true of the 1600s and ironically ever truer in the year 2018. In 1997, Zbigniew Brzezinski published his seminal work, The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives. Brzezinski had a distinguished career as professor of American policy at Johns Hopkins University before becoming the United States National Security Advisor during 1977 to 1981 under the administration of President Jimmy Carter. In his book, Brzezinski notes, "Eurasia is thus the chessboard on which the struggle for global primacy continues to be played, and that struggle involves geostrategy, the strategic management of geopolitical interests. It is noteworthy that as recently as 1940, two aspirants to global power, Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin, agreed explicitly in the secret negotiations of November of that year that America should be excluded from Eurasia. Each realized that the injection of American power into Eurasia would preclude his ambitions regarding global domination. Each shared the assumption that Eurasia is the center of the world and that he who controls Eurasia controls the world." Halford John Mackinder in 1904 stated the same with his Heartland Theory and his paper The Geographical Pivot of History, where he surmised his work in the interesting year of 1919. Who rules East Europe commands the Heartland. Who rules the Heartland commands the World Island. Who rules the World Island commands the world. And so, in the present day, after two devastating wars based in Europe and Russia, and a Cold War spanning the globe, we see an unfolding battle to control the Eurasian landmass and put Jerusalem at the center of a new world order. The future Prime Minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, stated in 1924 after visiting the Soviet Union, quote, "I'm a Bolshevik." We will be delving deeply into the founding of Israel by Polish and Russian communist Jews later, but just to give you a taste of what is to come, let me quote a little more, as you may find what I quote hard to believe. The quote, "I'm a Bolshevik," comes from an Israeli press article by journalist Tom Segev. Dated March 2013, Segev writes the title, "The USSR is our second homeland," said one kibbutznik when Stalin died. Incredible as it may seem, Stalin's Soviet Union was once at the center of Israeli identity. Let us quote extensively, as we'll set the tone for the whole video. Listen carefully. The death notice published in the Daily Al-Hamishma on May 6, 1953 quickly became one of the most cited documents in the history of Israeli politics. The United Workers Party, it said, was shocked upon hearing of the great disaster that befell the peoples of the Soviet Union. The world's proletariat and all of progressive humanity with the loss of the great leader and illustrious military commander, Joseph Vissarionovich Stalin. The Soviet dictator was described there as a great revolutionary fighter, responsible for immense historic endeavors. But contrary to what is usually remembered, the appellation Son of the Nations, as supporters like to refer to Stalin, did not appear in the paper's announcement. 60 years later, the death notice could be seen on David Sellers' nostalgia website as if it merits only amused wistfulness. In fact, it is of interest to recall, incredible as it may seem, that Stalin's Soviet Union was once at the center of Israeli identity. In the first Knesset, the left-wing Mapam, or United Workers' Party, was the second largest faction with 19 seats. During the debate over the makeup of the government that was held in the Knesset on March 10, 1949, one of Mapam's two leaders, Chiakov Hazan and Kibbutz Mishma Hamek, said, "For us, the Soviet Union is the fortress of world socialism. It is our second homeland, the socialist one." That comment could go down as one of the 10 most quoted sentences in the history of Israeli politics. I was not happy when Hassan voiced that sentiment, wrote Mihir Yahari, Mapam's senior leader a year later, although he went on to describe the People's Republic of China as a dictatorship that safeguards democracy there, adding, "This is the doctrine we have been nurturing for decades." Juicy. The article goes on. They were not the only ones harboring such sentiments, of course. David Ben-Gurion returned in 1923 from a visit to the Soviet Union and declared, "I am a Bolshevik." Moreover, many of this country's early inhabitants were Russian-born. They spoke Russian, read books and sang songs in Russian, and thought and dreamed in Russian. Many of them owed their lives to the Red Army's war against Nazi Germany. Stalin was considered the father of the victory over Hitler. The communists here had it easier. All they had to do was listen to Radio Moscow. Zionist socialists had a hard time living with the murderousness of the Son of the Nations and with communist-tainted anti-Semitism. Wrangling over whether to be sympathetic or disapproving split communities and destroyed families. The two great leaders of Mapam wrote a bevy of letters back and forth that were kept for posterity. They are enlightening and will quote a summary of the rest of the article. It seems that Yahari saw in Hassan's criticism of the Soviet Union a betrayal of their friendship. And, for his part, Hassan wrote in a most conciliatory tone, assuring his colleague that, "I am certain the Soviet Union is not a dead planet. I am certain a day will come when there too the sun of true socialist liberty will shine in all its essence. Then the objective historian will come along and explain that what happened during Stalin's era and what is happening there today were stages en route to the future. Just as the beheadings of Georges Jacques Danton was also one of the links on the way to victory of the great French Revolution." Journalist Tom Segev ends the article with this last line. Yahari died in 1987, aged 90. Hassan passed away in 1992 at 93. Plenty of years in which to admit countless times that he had erred in describing the Soviet Union as a second homeland. I gather after the quotes from the above article, you will begin to sense where this documentary is heading and are already pondering the ramifications of Israel and the United States being so close.
There's no press here.
You know? No, very little. We get very little. They don't like covering us.
But they like you in a very special way.
They like us. Thank you very much. It's a great honor to have Prime Minister Netanyahu and Mrs. Netanyahu with us. They've been friends for a long time. We have, I would say, probably the best relationships right now with Israel that we ever had. I think we're as close now as maybe ever before.
Trust me, it gets better. Here's another Ben-Gurion quote. Later, in 1962 in Life magazine, Ben-Gurion is quoted, "The image of the world in 1987 is traced in my imagination. The Cold War would be a thing of the past. Internal pressure of the constantly growing intelligentsia in Russia for more freedom and the pressure of the masses for raising their living standards may lead to a gradual democratization of the Soviet Union. On the other hand, the increasing influence of the workers and farmers and the rising political importance of men of science may transform the United States into a welfare state with a planned economy. Western and Eastern Europe will become a federation of autonomous states having a socialist and democratic regime. With the exception of the USSR as a federated Eurasian state, all other continents will become united in a world alliance at whose disposal will be an international police force. All armies will be abolished and there will be no more wars. In Jerusalem, the United Nations will build a shrine of the prophets to serve the federated union of all continents. This will be the seat of the Supreme Court of mankind to settle all controversies among the federated continents, as prophesied by Isaiah. With the above in mind, the emerging close relationship between Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel, Vladimir Putin of Russia, and Xi Jinping of China becomes more obvious. Understanding the central role of the Belt and Road Initiative to unfolding events, particularly in the Middle East, the Trump administration's main role becomes clearer in facilitating the final establishment of Greater Israel and the transfer of the U.S. high technology sector to Tel Aviv. This transfer of technology is occurring in the same manner as U.S. heavy industry and manufacturing were moved to China and Asia beginning under the Nixon administration. Interestingly, the same people are involved, most notably Henry Kissinger and the Council on Foreign Relations, along with a bevy of young 20-somethings at the time that included, ironically, Roger Stone and Dr. Steve Pachenik, players directly involved in bringing Donald Trump to power and keeping him there.
They are very similar in the sense that they're both brilliant, they're both combative, neither one is afraid to take on the media, that they appeal to the forgotten man, the silent majority, the blue-collar white Democrat that was part of the Nixon coalition, is now part of the Trump coalition. Ironically, it was former President Nixon who was, to my mind, the very first person who saw the possibilities of a Trump presidency. He met Donald Trump in George Steinbrenner's box in 1987 at a Yankees game, and the former president called me the next morning and said, "Well, I met your man. He's really got it. This guy could go all the way."
And Donald Trump, like Richard Nixon, cannot wait to hand billions in trade and technology to other countries, especially Israel, who is totally in bed with China. Every time the Don slaps a couple of hundred billion in tariffs and limits trade with China, in steps Israel with stolen US technology, and the trading bloc of Russia, China, Israel and the Belt and Road Initiative draw ever closer. This includes Turkey, who actually makes parts for the Lockheed crown jewel of technology, the F-35, as does Israel. Now they are all drawing closer together thanks to the Trump administration's policy making that clearly benefits Trump's owner, Netanyahu, and the Israeli firstocrat. Pachenik is of particular interest due to his incredible credentials, membership of the Council of Foreign Relations up until at least 2012, and employment as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State under Henry Kissinger, Cyrus Vance and James Baker. In early 2018, Dr. Steve Pachenik said this.
What are you seeing here?
Well, I'm glad you feel the storm come, but quite frankly, the storm was over a year ago when we brought in Trump. What you're seeing now is basically the aftermath of a major storm that had occurred with no one really understanding how Trump came in and how we and the intelligence community and others had helped to bring Trump to the forefront. The storm is over. Hillary is over. Mueller is over. The FBI is over. The CIA, certain elements are over. That's why Pompeo, who was number one at West Point, was put in. We have several military generals in charge. We have every congressional district. We have a military installation or project. So basically, we're not worried about any Democrats or congressmen. If you look at the map of the United States, we in the intelligence and military community are basically in charge. And Trump is on top of that. And I'm not upset about it, and I'll tell you why.
Despite Pachenik working closely with Alex Jones and Roger Stone, his name is never, ever mentioned in the mainstream media. This must be examined closely. With Trump mirroring Nixon, prone to say one thing and do another, we find Nixon making his name as a red-baiting ally of Senator Joseph McCarthy, but as president, he opened relations with communist China. Nixon ran for president based on a Southern strategy of appealing to the white devotees of Jim Crow, but his administration backed affirmative action. Nixon made his name as a conservative, but presided over the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency and expansion of the welfare state. And just like Nixon, the narrative presented in this video contends that Trump will talk a conservative pro-America talk while handing billions in contracts to Israel in a manufactured trade war with China. His aides and associates will talk an anti-communist talk.
China is in control of everything in America, but it's definitely being directed from China, and they plan to kill Trump in March. I thought I would just let people know that Fort Bragg's preparing for that.
Whilst facilitating the rise of Greater Israel in the same manner Nixon facilitated the rise of China. If there is one thing you will easily take from this documentary, is that Israel is a Russian client state, not an American one, and though the levels of control are debatable, Israel has always been a Soviet-era invention and backdoor to the West. Now, why haven't I heard about these Russian Soviet-era spy rings in Israel? No CNN or Alex Jones coverage here. And with Israel playing such a central role in the US high technology industry, filled with Soviet-era missile and aeronautical engineers, you can bet Elbit Systems, who is building major componentry for Lockheed's crown jewel, the F-35, is not full of alleged Jews from Yemen, Morocco, or Ethiopia. It's full of alleged Jews from Russia. Ask Israeli Defense Minister Avigdor Liebman, an alleged Jew from Russia who is widely considered a Soviet-era KGB asset by various commentators in Israel. Ask him. He loves the F-35. Even WikiLeaks revealed how close he is to Putin. But don't worry, my US taxpayer friends. I'm sure Lockheed and the US Defense Department considered all these things before handing over the best US taxpayer dollars could design and build to Israel and Russia. And China, and Iran, and big to India. You get the picture. No wonder Putin is smiling, as is President of China Xi Jinping, and even Rouhani in Iran.
My administration is reclaiming America's heritage as the world's greatest spacefaring nation.
And now, with Trump under orders from his handler, Bibi, building a U.S. Space Command without the grassroots support of the DOD and Secretary of Defense Mattis, you can bet the Israeli space industry is going to move along in leaps and bounds. And coincidentally, so will the Russian high-technology space sector. So is the Chinese high-technology space sector. They sure did hit the trifecta with those close relationships with Israel, didn't they? You better hope Mattis is everything the mainstream media alludes he is, a break or preferably a smack to the head of BB's boy Trump. Maybe Alex Jones will tell us all about it, Israel that is.
Who are we preparing to go to war against or defend ourselves from?
Senator, the Secretary of Defense outlined in the National Defense Strategy the challenges that we face. Part of the emphasis in the strategy was the shift from a focus on terrorism to great power competition, with a particular emphasis on the long-term challenges of China and Russia. It refers to both of those as opportunities for peaceful competition, deterrence, and then the ability to prevail in a conflict should we have to. The strategy is both a classified and unclassified option, but it lays out and goes through the challenges that we face.
So we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars defending ourselves from China, while major corporation after major corporation is shutting down in the United States of America and moving to China. Anything incongruous about that?
This is an emergency transmission from deep in the heart of Texas. The U.S. resistance against a global corporate combine empowered and funded by Communist China, allied with the big mega banks that set up Communist China in 1949. The Communist Chinese have taken control of U.S. telecommunications infrastructure. The Communist Chinese have taken control of Hollywood. The Communist Chinese have taken control of the main universities. This is all confirmed. This is not a drill. Big tech in Silicon Valley is almost completely run by the Communist Chinese government.
Nope, not quite yet. He's still on the Chinese communists. You never know. He may take the next step. And finally, what of America? Where will America sit at the end of all this, and how did it get from world superpower to teetering on the edge of economic and societal collapse?
You have a city, Boston. You have other cities and so many other cities. But I can tell you from very personal knowledge, New York City has virtually no construction right now. And we're not only talking about office buildings, of which there are many. We're talking about housing, moderate-income housing, low-income housing, even high-income housing, where you create jobs. You create so many other things. They buy carpet. They buy furniture. They buy refrigerators. They buy other things that fuel the economy. And incentive has to be put back into the construction of things that are
needed.
Tonight,
as I outline the next steps we must take as a country, we must honestly acknowledge the circumstances we inherited. 94 million Americans are out of the labor force. Over 43 million people are now living in poverty. And over 43 million Americans are on food stamps. More than one in five people in their prime working years are not working. We have the worst financial recovery in 65 years. In the last 8 years, the past administration has put on more new debt than nearly all of the other presidents combined. We've lost more than one-fourth of our manufacturing jobs since NAFTA was approved, and we've lost 60,000 factories since China joined the World Trade Organization in 2001. Our trade deficit in goods with the world last year was nearly $800 billion. And overseas, we have inherited a series of tragic foreign policy disasters. Solving these and so many other pressing problems will require us to work past the differences of party. It will require us to tap into the American spirit that has overcome every challenge throughout our long and storied history. But to accomplish our goals at home and abroad, we must restart the engine of the American economy, making it easier for companies to do business in the United States and much, much harder for companies to leave our country.
This documentary seeks to answer that question, at least in part. To do that, we must understand how it was infiltrated and co-opted by a little racist Marxist state posing as the fulfillment of biblical prophecy, Israel. We must understand how this little state, based on an ethereal form of Jewish identity politics, has the world by the throat via technology, and we must understand the specifics of how it transferred that technology to itself. We must understand the founding of Russia, Israel, and China as a product of the House of Rothschild private intelligence network operating through business and financial guilds and roundtable groups and lower-order secret societies such as Yale's Skull and Bones. We must understand that communism is a creation of central bankers designed to centralize command and control, not liberate the oppressed working classes. We must understand how this control system will morph into varying forms to suit the conditions of the day, but the same figures predominate. We must understand Israel's emerging role as cybersecurity watchdog and leader in the fields of robotics, AI, cryptocurrencies, and the application of blockchain technologies to a myriad of online activities in the emerging New World technological order. We must understand how this technology is being readied to herd the world's population into the UN Habitat Smart Cities program, where human beings will be chipped, surveilled, psychologically conditioned, vaccinated, sterilized, and supervised by a combination of AI and robotics, designed in Israel, manufactured in China. We must understand the politics of fear, psychology, spying, and above all, the art of lying with a straight face to an electorate in a permanent childlike state of infantile dependence and deference to authority figures. An electorate paralyzed by fear, hiding behind their keyboards and big screen TVs. They believe they slay dragons in their imaginary world of shadow banned, AI bot friends lists on Facebook and Twitter. Disengaged from the 3D world of political civil action, Soviet-era active measures at its finest. They blame commies, fascists, the alt-right, Antifa, the Black Pope, lizards, flat earth, the deep state, and even their mothers. They pray for deliverance and to be raptured to safety in the end times. They await a fatherly messiah hero come to dispense justice. They're always waiting. Disengaged, pondering imponderables, working out, attending their psychotherapist, brainwashed by organized religion to sit, do nothing, and await the Messiah, always waiting. If we can't face it and name it, God can't fix it, and an endless stream of messiah figures will lead us into technological bondage from which the human race may never escape. We need to name these things, and we need an urgent political dialogue on the ramifications for the entire planet, from street cafes to the corridors of power. We need this discussion, and we need it urgently. And finally, discussing issues of Jewish power and political Zionism brings forth the usual character assassination of anti-Semite, to name but a few assassination techniques. In this regard, British Jewish activist Paul Eisen says it best. The crime against the Palestinian people is being committed by a Jewish state with Jewish soldiers using weapons displaying Jewish religious symbols and with the full support and complicity of the overwhelming mass of organized Jews worldwide. But to name Jews as responsible for this crime seems impossible to do. Eisen's enlightening 2004 essay titled aptly, Jewish Power, forms the ethical and moral ground when approaching this sensitive issue. People must be individually and collectively held responsible for their actions and inaction in such dire times. The matters discussed have political and even spiritual ramifications, but the essence is simply one of a criminal investigation which involves acknowledging a prima facie case of wrongdoing exists, then moving forward with indictments based on reasonable suspicion and the gathering of evidence. This is not a mob justice issue, and the rule of law remains and will remain. There will be no repeat of 1933 to 1937 and beyond. Though to be sure, Benjamin Netanyahu and Vladimir Putin have both appeared extremely excited at the prospect of a mass exodus of highly educated white European and American Jews into both Israel and Russia. If it comes to that, watch for bagel crumbs by smashed synagogue windows in Brooklyn. And now to the question, how did a tiny little arrogant state built on notions of religious and racial supremacism become a seeming world power and make successive US administrations perform like a trained seal?